Hello.
Well, what can we say after that introduction?
Yeah, I'm Richard.
And I'm Fabian.
And we're Class War Games.
Yes, and we are normal and we want our freedom.
Yes, we have a much more relaxed attitude towards life, I think. So today we're going to start off with our usual news about what we've been doing. And then we're going to have an interview with Mark Coppleson from Coppleson Castings and a member of Class War Games.
Yes.
And then we're going to conclude.
Well, we've been working on our game.
Uprising.
Yes.
And so we're going to talk about our attempt to play it last night.
Yeah, which was, well.
Yeah, so last night at the Flea Pit, we had our regular club night.
It went really well, actually. Yes. I mean, it's the first time we tried the game out.
And we also played our other favourite game, one of our other favourite games, Comrade Cobra.
Yes.
And that did well. The two Pauls were there.
That's right, Paul and Paul.
One of them actually won the game.
Yes.
Okay, this is Comrade Cobra. So it shows that you can get an anarchist into Stalinist purges and they will come out on top.
Well, I don't know, talking about anarchists. So.
But the latest stages of ultra-leftism.
Well, we call it communism, comrade.
So we're going to have another club night on the 18th of August.
Yeah.
And we're going to try out this game again, Uprising, we're talking about later on.
Yes, I mean, we've learnt one or two lessons and we're going to discuss that learning process.
Later on.
Yeah, and so we'll be doing like version two.
Exactly, and also trying out some of our other favourites like Cobra or Scrunch or so on. And then, of course, we're sort of getting ready for the big festival at the end of September.
That's right. That's at the HTTP gallery.
Up in Manor House.
Yes, and it's quite interesting getting there because you go a little bit off the beaten track into a local housing estate.
Or industrial estate, actually, even beyond.
Well,
it.
You go through to that, then you find the jewel in the crown.
And we're going to be doing 2 days there, aren't we? I mean, the first day, as you have wonderfully titled it.
Well, yes. What we've got is we've got Marcel Duchamp meets Blue Peter.
This is making sort of self-creating games of war.
Well, yes, and part of it is it's like when I first heard of Ready Maze and all that, it just made me think of Valeria Singleton going, and here's one I made earlier. It's like
you can show his age here by which Blue Peter person you know.
Yes,
well, she was the sort of Connie Hucker of our generation.
Well, it's all gone forward since then, no doubt.
Dealt, yes. And then the next day on the Sunday, we'll be having the premiere.
World premiere
of the Class War Games video.
Yeah, this is what Ilsa Black's been working on.
And she's going to be coming in later on in this series of programmes to tell us all about it.
Yeah.
So we're going to go over now to Mark Coppleson from Coppleson Castings. Are you there, Mark?
I am, yeah.
All the way in Birmingham.
Hello there.
So Mark is one of the inner circle of the conspiracy. So it's nothing like promoting your own on air.
Absolutely.
So we've got some questions to ask you. And of course, I suppose the major one that everybody always thinks of is, how did you get into wargaming in the first place?
Well, I suppose, talking about Blue Peter and things, like back in the 60s when I was growing up, all that war stuff was everywhere. There were epic films, the Charlton Heston type thing, and Zulu, and there were lots of historical novels of the kind of adventure-y, boy's adventure type. And
you were a boy. This is what you're trying to tell us, are you?
That's basically it. Yes, it's as simple as that, isn't it? Yeah.
And you wanted to refight battles on your bedroom floor?
Everything I ever read or watched, I wanted to find the fighty bits of it and replay it at home, I suppose.
Oh, yes, we're making this video at the moment, and I must admit, I actually suddenly reverted back to a small boy and started watching films where I was just skipping forward to the battle sequences to see if there was anything we could sample. And if there was a love scene, I'd go, oh, how boring, let's just get through that quickly.
Well, somewhere at the back of my mind, actually at the front of my mind, I'm still a bit like that. I try hard not to be, but it's that's the reality. I think even the last few days I've skipped through some film looking for the battle scene.
And checking whether the uniforms were correct.
Well, that comes on later, I think. It was absolutely everything. I remember even when I read Wind in the Willows, I was quite excited because I have that battle when the weasel occupied Toad Hall.
So this is going to be your new range of characters, is it?
Someone else actually does it. Seriously, I don't. But when I was little, I'd go back home because you couldn't buy all the toys, the merchandise stuff then, and I'd make everything out of plasticine. May the Stoats and the Weasels. And
wow.
Oh, this is a hidden part of your youth coming out.
Well, actually, this leads to the next question, and that is about how you went from that to setting up Cobblestone Castings.
That's one of those long things, isn't it? How do you go from having a kind of a comparatively normal life to doing an odd job? I was always quite interested in that when I went to university, and you forget about it and you push it to the back of your mind because it's pretty uncool and no one wants to talk to you about it.
And what were you doing at university?
I did Russian and Soviet studies.
Uh-huh.
Now, actually, I didn't do a lot of work. I did spend a lot of time in the library secretly reading sort of military history books and things like that.
So what, hidden underneath the collected works of Lenin?
That kind of thing, yeah. It was like going to a shop and buying pornography magazines, I suppose. You had to hide it or something. You know, so yes, it was much more acceptable to read Lenin. So I hid all that stuff. But then, after university, I had some proper jobs. I was a primary school teacher. I was a civil servant. You know, I worked in sort of publishing for a bit. I even edited the Tufty Times, the road safety newspaper, for a bit. And then I saw an advert for a sculptor, and I thought, I bet I can do that. And so I made a figure. And I sent it off, and they offered me a job.
And who was the they?
That was Games Workshop, who were kind of the big company in the wargaming scene. Right,
the McDonald's.
Yeah, the equivalent to McDonald's of wargaming. They do their own kind of fantasy and science fiction games.
Warhammer is what most people would probably know them as.
Yeah, Warhammer and Warhammer 40K for the science fiction. So that was good, you know. I learned a lot, and I worked with, you know, a lot of really good sculptors. And, you know, I left them after a few years and went somewhere else and they went bust and I went somewhere else and they went bust and I went somewhere else. And so it goes. And you run through a few, you know, always making a living, but you realise that it's not that stable. And also I realised I didn't really like having to do what other people wanted me to do. So eventually I set up for myself.
And you decided you didn't want to make science fiction figures anymore.
Well, actually, I don't mind doing that, but it's something about being told to do anything. I just realised I'm not a very good employee, really.
So what were you like as a school teacher then?
I was...
It's all right if you could tell other people what to do. Yeah?
Well, that's the bit I quite liked. It was before it was a national curriculum, though. So, you know, a primary school teacher, you were pretty much the lord of your own classroom. And because I was into sort of art and things like that, we did everything through that.
And played lots of games.
Well, as many as I could get in. You know? Game box and things like that. So, you know, that's the way it goes.
So then how do you actually then get into the business of making figurines? In like, you know, setting up your own business.
Well, I knew how to make the masters. And as it happened, I met some guys here in Birmingham who knew of a contract caster. That's someone who would make the moulds and cast the metal figures as a sort of self-employed person, which was the missing link. So I just went to him and said, look, I'll make the figures, can you cast them for me? And that's how it went, and it kind of suited me, really. I never wanted to be either an employee or an employer, actually. I've always preferred working with other people who are sort of just self-employed.
So you're an artisan.
Gone on from there, really.
You're an artisan.
I know. I that kind of William Morris sort of...
Yeah.
Art of craftsman kind of thing, yeah. I never thought of myself as a sculptor or anything like that, although it's currently what people call themselves. I always wanted to be a sort of more of a designer.
Yeah. So tell us about the sorts of things that you sell at Cobblestone Castings.
Well, we have a few ranges, mostly because I work for myself. I only really make what interests me at any given moment, so we have a slightly odd catalogue. I do a kind of... a 1920s Russia and Central Asia range. I have some science fiction. I've just started a little range of 1670s, like the rise of Louis XIV, which is one of those odd periods I'm interested in, but probably no one else is.
So what's your best-selling range of figurines?
I'm a pretty bad businessman, so I honestly... haven't got the slightest idea. I sit in my workroom, you see, and my wife packs the order, so I sit and stare in space and watch DVDs and read books and things and don't pay much attention. I think probably it's the 1920s stuff, although I did a little range of, little in several ways, of very small figures 10 mil, 1 centimetre high fantasy figures, which do sell very, very well.
So are you going to make more of those then?
Well, I'm a bit obsessed with making tiny figures, but my eyes, because of my age, I think, are not quite up to it. But I do love the idea of, I've always had this fantasy of having one of those old map cabinets, you know, with lots of flat drawers, and pulling out a little drawer, and inside was the whole world. You know, I don't know. Yeah. You know, this is my Europe in 1939. This is the Caribbean in 1660. It's about those little micro worlds, I think.
It's because we had Harry Pearson on. We were interviewing him recently, and he said the same thing, that one of the attractions of wargaming with figurines is that you get this miniature world feeling out of it.
I think that's what I like from it. I mean, I remember when I was little at school, you know, primary school, as soon as Easter came and all the insects came out again, I used to go out and I'd map the activities of the ants in the garden. I'd even mark them so I could trace them and things like that. I like that miniature stuff, you know.
So the general of the ants, it's the next
something
great...
like that, yeah, yeah. I think it always risks disappearing somewhere, smaller and smaller, though.
Okay, but the next question's about actually the trip to St. Petersburg.
Which we all did.
Yes, and it's, how did it feel playing with your Russian Civil War soldiers in the office of the General Staff in the Hermitage?
It's strange, isn't it? I've thought about that quite a lot, because it should have been really historically resonant, because, you know, Petersburg's a great city, and the building we're in shows one of the staff offices. But actually, I suppose you get very pulled into doing the game and doing an actual activity. And the actual event was quite odd. Most war game events are full of men who look something like me, you know, middle-aged men, got shaven heads, little beards and glasses and wear black leather jackets. And it wasn't quite like that. It was mostly young women who obviously, I suspect, went to a lot of arts events.
Yes.
So it had this very slightly unrelaxed atmosphere, and I never really understood what they were there for.
Well, I think the other problem is that they couldn't smoke or drink at it.
That probably made a difference. And you know, I got my head down anyway, and I was doing things, and you get into a kind of hyper state when you talk very fast and you don't really know what's happening.
Well, I think it was quite monumental, right? In the sense that it was probably the first time in the history of the world. So, a war gaming event, there were more women than men.
I think it probably was, yeah. So that alone makes it a historic event.
I mean, it was interesting, though, having it in that location, because those people who've seen Sergei Eisenstein's October movie, we were actually walking up these flight of stairs where in the fantasy recreation of the revolution, 1917 October Revolution, they run up and liberate this room that we were in.
Yeah.
And that was quite odd to be there, I thought.
And also, the question is, was that the room where the British tried to entice the Russian Imperial Staff to join them in a revolt against the Bolsheviks? Shortly before the person who was foolish enough to go along with this idea got killed at a railway station by a mob of angry soldiers, and the Bolsheviks were unable to defend him.
So we have all those sort of historical resonances. Do you feel that, though, when you have something like you're doing something in miniature and there we are in somewhere where it was historically happening in a way?
I suppose so, yeah. And I would love to have explored it a bit more, actually. Because of the nature of the event, we were kind of hustled out rather quickly at the end.
Well, the Tsarist bureaucracy was still in charge.
It had the strangest feeling to me. It was the bit of that trip to Russia that reminded me most of going to Soviet Union in the 70s, which I did several times when I was at university. It had that slightly awkward atmosphere of a Soviet staged event with foreigners there, when someone would come up and tell you about something and everyone would look slightly uneasy.
Yes, I think that's exactly what it was, only you just use the word Russian nowadays.
Yes. I find it hard, actually. I slip all the time. As I was talking about it, I find it very difficult not to call it Leningrad, you know.
Well, yes.
Or Petrograd is the case.
Well, right? Yes.
So I was just thinking about whether you were thinking of doing anything more about using these Russian Civil War range you're doing at the moment.
I think that particular range is probably stopped temporarily, at least. I'm slightly obsessed with the idea of coming up with something that's somewhere in between a traditional war game that has, you know, hundreds of painted figures and takes you years to prepare, and traditional board games that people can get out.
Because when we did the event at the Victoria and Albert Museum, you were showing this prototype of this Kiss Kiss Bang Bang.
Oh, yeah, that's our 60s Spy Grange. And that went very well, actually. And
you had lots of good feedback. I remember on the night there were lots of people who liked that because you had a sort of spy base, which was like a board, wasn't it? A board game.
Yeah, and we've worked on that, and actually rather slowly, but we've pretty much got it to a state where we'll make it available, I think. Yeah, that's good fun. We just decided we'd like to do a game based on 60s spy films, not so much the reality of 60s spy, which is probably a little grim and perhaps a bit slow and involves a lot of paperwork.
And torture sessions.
Yes, all kinds of things.
A bit like that game War and Peace.
Either side of range. But no, so we've kind of honed it down. So it started off as being a kind of war gamey thing with miniatures and making bases, but actually it's moved more and more into a kind of a simple board game, a bit more complicated than you know, Cluedo or Monopoly or something, but a lot less, a lot easier to play than a traditional war game, which is a bit of a labour of love, I must say.
Though when we played the game at the Hermitage, those sort of old-school wargaming rules, they were pretty simple, your friend who wrote them.
Oh, they were. I don't think it's the rules themselves. I think it's actually there's a lot of time. You've got to put a lot of time into it to paint a couple of hundred figures and to make terrain, buildings and all the rest of it. It's quite demanding, and I know a lot of my friends don't wargame at all. I don't wargame very much, though I think about it quite a lot. But they probably would play a game that they could get out and set up in an evening.
Well, I mean,
commit 6 months of their life to it, though. Well, you know?
One of the things after we've worked on Vienna, I'm very interested in making a game around Tashkent.
This is in the
Russian, 1917 to 1923. That's a kind of period.
So he's going to be adapting your range if you're not careful, Mark.
Well, that's a very interesting period. Well, you have all these multiple sides, don't you? In very unclear positions.
And people changing sides.
Armenians and British and the Turks involved and everyone,
So tell us exactly about the mechanisms of Kiss Kiss Bang Bang. Well, I mean, you're going to have it in a box?
I think, because basically we don't have the money to do a big box game, which is incredibly expensive. Mm. What we're going to do, I think, is sell miniatures as we do normally, sort of unpainted and single, but actually we're going to have sort of missions, and each mission, which will be a kind of plan of a missile base or a casino with a beachfront or something, will be sort of a poster, I think.
All right, and there are going to be some gorgeous busty blondes, are there?
We've got a mechanism for using them. You can be a sex bomb as part of the rule. Sex, the gender is not particularly important. You can play it however you like, but
Sarah, our producer, is cracking up at this point.
Well, it works. The sex bomb can come into a room and all the other players sort of lose their turn, effectively. We're overcome by it.
Yes.
I hope Pam is, who's Mark's wife, is positively vetting the rules of this game.
Oh, she can cope. But, yeah, it's nothing offensive there. As long as you remember it's the 1960s.
That's true. And anyway, she survived appearing at lots of war game conventions selling Colson's castings, didn't she?
She manages it with a smile that sort of descends into, she does. Yeah.
Okay, well, look, thanks a lot. Well, that was a great...
Yes.
Thank you. I'm sure we'll be in contact soon. And thanks a lot for us, and we'll see you soon.
Okay, speak to you soon.
Take care, bye.
Bye.
Okay, that was Mark Cobbleston.
Yes, a part of our Class War Games up in Birmingham there.
Mark, actually, I think it sort of segues quite nicely into what we're doing last...
Segue.
Yes.
Oh, you're using all these posh words now.
Yeah, well, you see, he's getting involved in doing too many radio programmes.
Oh, right. Anyway, these segues takes us to...
What we did last night, which is trying out the our own game, Uprising. I mean, we've been, over the weeks, we've been reviewing lots of other people's games.
But actually, at the same time we've been playing these games, we've been working on our own game. And I'd just like to underline something that Mark said. And one of the things we're dedicated to doing here is having very simple rules. People don't want to, spend an evening learning the rules before you even play the game.
Like the Triumph of Chaos with its famous 36 pages of rules, and its 36 pages of supplementary rules.
Exactly. We're approaching a very definite historical event, sometimes called the Austrian Civil War, sometimes called the February Uprising.
Yes, which is when the Austrian Social Democrats basically tried to resist Catholic fascism in Austria in 1934.
Exactly. And so we've got a map of Vienna.
nicely abstracted, thanks to one of our other Class War Games comrades, Stefan Lushinger.
Yes, so he's done a really good job.
And we've taken ideas from other games. Obviously, Guy Debord's The Game of War.
Yes, and the Japanese game Go is very...
Or Chinese game Wei Shi.
Well, maybe so, yeah.
But the pieces are sort of similar to Go pieces.
Yes, and that gives it a certain aesthetic, so that like on the board, that you're, each turn you're putting more stones on. Now, there are occasions when you're taking stones off, but you're more putting stones on, and you're actually filling the board in the same way that Go does, and then that makes it a very territorial game.
And I think the other thing we did was we really liked this Austerlitz game we've talked about called Napoleon's Triumph, where you had blocks and hid what the forces were until they hit the enemy's troops.
Yes.
And we've adapted that by having the pieces so they have the what it says they are on one side and they're covered on the other. They're basically blank, so you can hide pieces until they get into contact or you use them in special ways.
Yes, and we decided to have a very simple way of dealing with this, and we use the numbers 1, 2, and 3,
and L for leaders,
and yeah, that's 4 altogether. We thought that's quite complicated enough.
Yes, enough additions for people to
do. I mean, if we bring in the artillery, that might mean something else.
Ooh.
We're a bit way off that at the moment.
And then, of course, we took ideas from games like Coup and so on, and other games which we haven't actually talked about, like the Unhappy King Charles, where
and that game, the Metropolitan Police Play with demonstrators.
Yes, where they kettle people.
Yes.
Yes, they must have a game somewhere where they practice and learn how to do that. So we took some ideas like that about seizing territory, about surrounding people.
And yes, I mean, one of the things that came up in it was that actually, if you can force your opponent into a kind of traffic jam, it makes it hard for them to move, and the pieces they want. Because the other division we did was in the colour of the pieces.
That's true, between fast and slow ones.
Yes, and so we had yellow and green as the two colours. So the yellow would have one movement, one turn basically, and the greens would have two turns because they'd be motorised units. So, and I think that gave a certain kind of extra little bit, because the other thing is we've got these dice, which are different. They're kind of cubic dice, like a 1 to 6 dice, except they go 1, 2, 3 and repeat it. So 1, 2, 3, 1, 2, 3. So actually the range that you throw on the dice.
Well, you do regret there were some other dice you did want to have, which were called extreme dice.
Anarchist
dice.
Yes.
Bolshevik dice, which only have 1s and 6s or 2s and 5s.
Yes, and then there's the social democratic dice, which don't have 1s and 6s at all.
Well, that's for me.
Double up in 3s and 4s.
Oh, we're just centrists. Yeah, so we have those things, which I think, again, work quite well. So we tried it out, and you can, if you look at our Facebook page, I've put up some photos today, so you can get a rough idea. We made a sort of, you know, we did this board using China Graph pencils. We've got these pieces. Yeah. We started playing it out, and it's interesting. You have ideas, and you try bits of a game, but then when you first put it out onto a board and you start playing it for real, suddenly you can see what works and what didn't.
Yes, and you can muck around doing stuff on your own, but really when you've got two people playing it, and then suddenly you realise that you've got different interpretations of
the rules.
Yes, which haven't been written down. Oh, but...
Yes, then you have an argument about who... And then you suddenly realise you don't want to argue about the rules, because that's you're trying to work out what the rules are, not to win the game.
Exactly. Well, that was... I mean, that's another experience of wargaming, is that usually what happens here, it goes on until there's an argument about the rules.
Yes. So we found that actually the early stages worked quite well, and then it sort of started to block up the game, didn't it?
Yes, because what happened was we... when people were drawn together, linked up together, because we're using some of the ideas from Guy Debord's game of having groups linked together, they became a lot stronger. But then eventually both sides had all their forces linked together, and it was just, well, who's got more forces on the board? And fortunately it was the fascists.
Yes, because I happened to be playing the fascists and got my pieces on the board for it. And so it immediately shows there's a weakness in the game, because when you're playtesting something, what you're trying to do is try to work out ways that the game can continually fork, so it's not always following a predetermined pattern. I think one of the things we found out right from the beginning of this playtesting is there's obviously an optimum move, which is to attack the enemy's bases.
Yes, and I think what's going to happen is we're going to change the combat rules. I think maybe not having it, all the forces linking together, otherwise we were getting up to, what, 20, all like halfway across the border still involved in this. So I think we're going to go through a process of refining that. But I think what impressed me about it was that the beginning of the game worked. The idea was that you come out of your base and you sort out what you want to do. So, I mean, you took two of my bases and I took one of your bases, which, I mean, that, and then you had a distinct advantage because you were bringing more forces on all the time. But I think that putting in a little few, some more side streets might change the dynamic. But, hey, that was the first time out, the beginning of the game. If we hadn't got the beginning of the game right, we wouldn't be talking about the next day.
No, and I think the other thing is that one of the things we'd like people to do is to actually think of Vienna in a different way. I mean, so you suddenly, instead of having Vienna being, you know, all the chocolate box touristy things, the Austro-Hungarian Empire, suddenly...
You start talking about the Viennese secession soon, won't you?
Yeah, well, they're suddenly we're fighting over Karl Marxhof, which is a council estate, or the arsenal or something like this, or the water supply. So suddenly you actually see the city in a quite different way.
Yes, yes. Maybe we should be fighting around the architecture of the Viennese secession.
Yes, but in a way it will be. I think that's something you can bring into... I mean, that was one of the other things, is how do you make the territory of the board interesting? Because there's something else we found out from playing these games, is to, again, stop people all bunching into one part of the board. We found that with that coup game, which we quite liked, except there was a sort of optimal strategy on the board.
Actually, I was reminded of that coup game in the very nice run-up they did to our broadcast when they were talking about the power of radio.
Yeah.
Because what happens then is, by seizing the radio, you can then get more pieces and bring more pieces into play.
But we needed to have more different things on the ball which allow you to do things like that.
Well, the railways worked, didn't they? And what we had at the stations, the station consisted of a double space. Mm. And if you had one unit in there, then the empty space, each turn you bring on a reinforcement. Basically, you know, like you'd be your mates coming up from Linz or Graz
or somewhere else.
Who, you know, and so that worked. But for the other locations, we didn't really have any functioning rules which made having that, aside from being an objective for victory. So really, we've kind of, that's the first step. And now the next step is to integrate all the different parts, which will... take the game through and enable it to actually work in a number of different ways.
So come along the 18th of August at the Fleet Pit in Columbia Road, and we'll have another go. We'd be interested to get other people to try out. And we're going to set up a wiki page to sort of work on the rules.
Work on the rules, yes. Yeah, so, you know, people be able to download the rules and...
make their own set.
Yeah.
Okay. So we're looking at Sarah now.
Is that it?
Yeah. No, I don't know. So thank you very much for listening.
Yes, thank you.
I'm Richard Barbrook.
I'm Fabian Thompson.
And we were Class War Games. Yeah.